This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The newest new frontier on television this season is alternate realities. The X-Files explores extraterrestrial phenomena. The series Sliders takes viewers on a weekly excursion into a parallel universe. And then there's VR5. VR5 is a one-hour adventure series on Fox. Its title refers to Virtual Reality Level 5, which is a high-tech window into the subconscious. My guest is VR5's creator and executive producer, John Sacret Young. He says virtual reality technology is progressing so fast, it's hard to keep the show up to date. John Sacret Young is a new convert to the high-tech special effects that VR5 features. He's best known as the creator and producer of the hit series China Beach, a weekly drama set during the Vietnam War. He's also written the screenplays for the films Testament and Romero. The producers of VR5 conceive of 10 levels of virtual reality. I asked John Sacret Young to describe Level 5.
Well, I think probably in what we can do now, we are somewhere about what we would call VR3, and Virtual Reality 5 is a couple of steps beyond that. And what our character, Sydney Bloom, has discovered that she can do is she, using her computer, can take another person and their subconscious to a landscape that she programs and take herself. And there the two subconsciouses meet. And so she can find out things that people aren't necessarily wearing on their sleeve but are carrying inside themselves. But she cannot control what she sees or what happens in there. And in a way, we've often talked about how it's a little bit like connecting perhaps your waking dream and your sleeping dream, that she can see in there symbols and she can see behavior, but sometimes things come colliding in that she did not anticipate. And they can be funny and they can be outrageous or they can be at times terrorizing.
Were you at all daunted in the beginning by the challenge of creating visuals for something that's before its time?
I think the challenge for me and for us was much about a number of things. One was, is there a way to create a different kind of television show? And how then do you make it look different? And who would be an interesting character to put into that landscape, if you will? And I think there are many shows in television, and television is now based in what I call a kind of rigidly franchised universe where you exist in a sea of cops, lawyers, and doctors. And we wanted to find a way to do something a little different and a little unique. And the concept of doing things in virtual reality seemed to us to be provocative. Provocative because I think it is an oncoming technology and an oncoming almost source of information escape and adventure. But also a way as a storyteller to maybe say, hey, I can play the scene in reality and I can play almost the same scene or a similar scene in virtual reality and it will be different. And it's a way, I suppose, to correct the first scene or a way to do it differently or a way to have a different point of view about that similar or same scene. And as a dramatist, that's a very provocative and very interesting.
The character, Sydney Bloom, is played by the actress Laurie Singer, and she's really a haunted and twisted character. Her father and her sister died in her twin sister died in a car crash that Sydney survived. The mother is catatonic after this. I'd like to play a clip. And here Sydney is in VR5. She's in a mock courtroom setting, and she's questioning her father about his past.
Why did you lie to your family? Why did you kiss them goodbye and tell them you were going to the university? And then come home and have supper and play with them and then kiss them goodnight? And the whole time, there was a big part of you were leaving out, weren't you?
Objection! Counsel is leading the witness.
Overruled.
Which part?
The committee.
Objection! This is irrelevant, Your Honor!
Overruled.
Yes. I was a member.
Why did you lie to your family?
I was trying to protect.
You are protecting yourself. What did you do to me? How come I'm the only one who can go into VR5? I don't know who I am. I don't know what I am. I'm afraid of myself.
The virtual reality allows this character to keep exploring and revisiting her past. Is this what initially intrigued you about the show, more than the high-tech visuals?
Well, I think one of the things that interested us was we have all this concern about, let's call it the millennium coming, whether it's the year 2000 or whether it's the information superhighway. And the truth seems to be that as the future comes at us, it also, sometimes mysteriously, but inevitably connects to the past. And what Sydney is discovering is she thinks that she is homebrewed a way to kind of, by accident, fall into her unique ability to do what she does, is to take people into VR5. What she doesn't realize yet is that it connects to her memory and that her kind of obsession with this is really also an unveiling of how the facts of her personal life, the facts of her memory, the facts of her history are indeed in some ways fiction. And it's almost like as she takes other people's in and other people into VR5 and takes herself in, it's like peeling an onion. And as the layers of the onion peel away, she discovers that what she thought to be true is in fact false. And she has to rediscover what actually happened to her.
How much do you have to go through to achieve the VR effects? And by that, I mean, how much is done in post-production? How many layers of technical effects are there?
If you just take the main title of our show, there is sometimes 5, 6, 7 layers of picture kind of one on top of the other, dissolving in or dissolving out. And within that, there may be visual effects within each of those layers. So it becomes more and more complicated. And I think more and more daring and trying to push what you can do and discovering that it can be pushed. We use a process this year called CST where you take color film and you go back to black and white and then you recolor it, which leads to sometimes outrageous choices or moody choices. And that takes time. It takes them 15 business days to accomplish that task. And on a television schedule, that can be a little bit like you feel as if the film is going wet right on the air. You run out of time. That's as much time as you can take. But it is very much a post-production process. It becomes more and more important.
The main character, Sydney, uses a modem called an acoustic coupler. It has a phone receiver on it. It's part of her technique. And this modem, I'm told, is really antiquated. It hasn't been used in years. And I only know this because there are plenty of hackers out there picking apart each episode on the internet and on the computer bulletin boards, and they ridicule each mistake or perceived mistake in technology or in technical lingo. How concerned are you with keeping the show absolutely technically state of the art?
Well, I think we chose that for two reasons. One is it was visually simple and clear as to what was happening, and we felt that would help make her entering this world of VR5 accessible to an audience. And number two, we are, this is fiction, so there is a certain amount of license. But in addition, as I hear the stories of what's going on the internet, we've kept very quiet because everyone thinks it's about technology, when in fact her ability to do this is going to be revealed to be not so much about technology as probably about genetics. And it comes from her family and her father programming her. And she doesn't know that yet. And so it isn't about computer expertise as much as it is about probably what's going on in her own and her father's cerebellum. It's about ultimately the mind as a computer as opposed to, you know, her screen that is right in front of her.
So they're on the wrong track, in other words.
Right, right.
Are you a computer hacker yourself?
Absolutely was not. I was a guy who wrote with a pen or a pencil on scuzzy, sleazy yellow paper for as long as I could. And I've only worked on a laptop for, I think it's still less than 2 years. Though I could always type, I enjoyed and felt like a kinship, I suppose, to those who used to work with their hands, and that if I didn't have a writer's bump on the knuckle of my middle finger, I felt like something was wrong in my life. So this is kind of this show has helped pull me kind of mewling and screaming into the late 20th century.
There are such a thing as VR boutiques, I understand, in Boston and in L.A. Have you been to any?
Oh, yes. We went down to San Diego, and there's some in the San Fernando Valley, and there's one in Pasadena, whether it's called Virtual World or it's there's a number of these things popping up, and they are interesting and exciting and intriguing, but they are not, of course, to the level of where we're going. And will we get to that level or how soon? I don't think anybody has the answer. But one of the fascinating things is that Laurie Singer and I went down to Princeton University, where we met with two professors, one who showed us kind of what I would call an art walk, where you can now kind of go, let's say, to the Sistine Chapel, and you can, rather than just being on the ground staring up, you can, you know, it's almost like you are back there and you are on your back and you too are painting it. And you can get into that perspective. You can feel as if you're in three-dimensional space, getting that close and actually see the brush strokes. So it's an amazing world that's taking place. And it is, I think, the lure of the couch potato getting to meet Marilyn Monroe, but is also clearly an educational tool that is oncoming.
I'm speaking with John Sacred Young. He's the executive producer of the new Fox TV series, VR5. He also created and wrote the hit series China Beach and wrote the screenplays for the feature films Testament and Romero. Let's take a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with writer and producer John Sacred Young. You created the hit series China Beach. It's about an arrest and recreation station in Da Nang, Vietnam. And that series also featured women as the lead characters. Is it your preference or just a coincidence that a lot of your TV work focuses on a woman's point of view?
Well, when I started writing, I'd spent a lot of time as a kid, you know, in locker rooms. I played sports. And I think I kind of suffered at some point from locker room overload of hanging around, you know, with too many sweat socks. And it was, in the 80s, a very interesting dilemma to think about all the issues that face women starting in the 60s. And how do you keep the plates in the air of having a personal life, having a business life, having a career, making money, dealing with children? The women's movement seemed to gain so many things, but it also how much did it gain? How much were losses? What were the compromises that had to be made? And that was, I thought, very fertile territory for drama and for storytelling and for the creation of characters.
You once said something interesting about writing for the actress Dana Delaney, who played the lead role in China Beach. You said that she moves in silence. When you write for her, you cut out words. What did you mean by that, and how do you cut out words?
Well, early on in that show, Dana and I had almost like an argument where she kept saying to me, you keep saying you want less, less. You know, pretty soon I'll be doing nothing. And I said, exactly. And she came up to me at some point and said, I get it. You want me to play Clint Eastwood? And I said, well, maybe not Clint Eastwood, but maybe Henry Fonda. And one of the things about that show was, in an odd way, it was almost a Western where this strange group of people had gathered together on an outpost or a fort or whatever, except of course it wasn't a Western, it was an Eastern because it took place in Vietnam. And she being the center of the show, the mast of the boat, the kind of crucial element in the ensemble, silence fit that character and fit what she can do so extraordinarily as an actress, which is she doesn't have to speak, that we as an audience can read the emotion she's carrying and we draw closer to her. And it isn't through words, it is through her face and through her actions. And part of the immense power, I think, in movies, whether you're dealing with, you know, you could probably go back as far as Lillian Gish, or you certainly could go through the entire, let's say, John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, whatever, is not about action movies, it's about reaction, that we watch the faces, and those faces, in the emotions in those faces, we draw close.
You didn't serve in Vietnam, but your co-producer, William Broyles, did. How did your collaboration work? Did he supply stories and characters from his own experience and you refine them?
Well, I think we met at a very, I think it was a matter of synchronicity that we met. I had written about Vietnam before. I wrote, I think it's the only miniseries done to date about Vietnam, called A Rumor of War, based on Philip Caputo's book about his time there. And Bill had seen that, and he actually at first had the idea of doing a half-hour comedy, kind of set in Saigon, where a number of women entertainers come. And we started talking, and I, from my point of view and from my interest, said, God, wouldn't it be interesting to do a drama where you would shoot it on film and not on a sound stage, and you could get that real, you know, that more gritty feeling. And I think he was very taken by that idea, and his experiences were obviously crucial to the show. But even more, I think it was our goal from the beginning was to involve veterans, to hear their stories and to have them a part of the process. So that on the pilot alone, I would say we talked to at least 40 vets. And then each year before the show began shooting, we would have a weekend where we would invite vets to come and talk to us and spend time with us, with the actors, with the writers. And probably the most famous and maybe the episode that had the most accolades was an episode we did called Vets, where we interviewed on tape mostly women veterans. And we took those interviews and intercut them with footage from the show. And when we did it, ABC, the show was on ABC, was kind of went into massive alarm that people would be confused or people would turn off because, again, we were kind of connecting reality to fiction. And in fact, what happened was just the opposite. We got the most mail, the most response, the ratings weren't affected, and the show went on to win the Peabody Award, among others.
I read somewhere when you first came to L.A., you tried to get a job on the police force?
It is true. It was the time of Vietnam, and I thought a little bit, you know, America is so messed up, and where are we going to go? And there was choices. Should I stay here and where there were riots going on in the urban areas, or should I go to Southeast Asia? What should I do? And my choice was, however foolish or wrongheaded, was to say, well, let me stay here. And it was somewhat with the purpose in mind of, you know, I want to be a writer. Where is there going to be material? And it seemed to me that in the late 1960s, America was in such a turbulent place that there was plentiful, rich, interesting material. And my thought was, well, I'll become a cop, because they've got to be in this dilemma about, you know, how do I enforce things on the street when, in fact, we seem to be so mixed up, and how would that tear me apart as a policeman? You know, I'm not sure that was the sanest thing to do, and I think the LAPD where I applied looked at me and thought, this guy comes from the Ivy League, he's got long hair, he's got a mustache. Before it was de rigueur for LAPD cops to have a mustache. I don't know about this guy. He's pretty suspect. So I think we eventually kind of gaze at each other with equal suspicion.
Well, you didn't get the job. In fact, you flunked the eye test. What kept you in L.A.?
Well, for one thing, I come from the East Coast, and part of my journey was, as it is with many people, is let me get out of town, let me get as far away from where I grew up as possible so that I can grow up and have a chance and, I suppose, get away. And L.A. was pretty far away, as far as I could go in the continental United States, and it was so different that at first it was, you know, at one level I hated it. At another level, hate kind of almost burnishes material from you. It makes you alive. It makes you observe. It gets the emotions going. So in a way, as I hated it, I kind of fell in love with it. And it drew me because it was so different.
You wrote a novel about former stuntmen, The Weather Tomorrow. And these guys drink a lot. They did drugs. They carouse. They also worked in the movie industry. And it made me think that the movie industry can give a writer a lot of raw material to work with.
Well, I don't know. I've never been, I think, that excited about novels, about literally the movie industry. But the fringes of it have produced a kind of extraordinary body of work. And they're never big novels. They're small, kind of eccentric, but very intense ones. The Day of the Locust, Play as It Lays. I mean, there's a number of them. And that was kind of where I came from. It wasn't about wildly successful Hollywood producers or directors. It wasn't about stars. It was about that other world of, you know, which is 90% of it. Those on the fringes, those who could make it but don't, those who are still hanging out for that call from the agent or that, you know, that golden dream that might take place but seldom does.
Well, you have a novel coming out next year. Is it a relief for you to sit down and write your own novel all by yourself after working in the TV industry, which seems to be more of a chaotic group effort?
Writing a novel is the greatest pleasure and the biggest nightmare that I can imagine. When it's going well, there's nothing better. But the percentage of the time that it's going well is, if you're lucky, maybe 5 or 10%. And so the rest of the days and nights are like anarchy. And the story that I'm trying to tell, which is about one American family, really from the close of World War II through the late 1980s. And again, it touches upon Vietnam, which is kind of the black, dark nexus of that time, as you take this family to the kind of hurricane of the 60s and 70s. I discover I'm now dealing, of course, though I went 3,000 miles away to escape my family, of course, I'm closing the circle now and dealing with many of the things that I saw and felt as I grew up.
John Sacred Young, I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you very much for coming on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
John Sacred Young is the creator and executive producer of VR5, a new TV series on Fox. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.